Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. I mean, whatever you think about the president, in fairness, there's never a dull moment with him these days. So he's on the front of the Business Post today. Ireland is playing with fire in dangerous drift towards NATO, and he's in flying form, you'd have to say, in this piece. And I think the Business Post's going to leak this out last night, so there is due consternation in various quarters already. The Sunday Times, Varadkar, no vacancy at the top of Fine Gael, and that is, he's Leo Varadkar's in a couple of papers today, I suppose, steadying the ship, as he might view it. The Sunday Independent, their front page is a very sad interview with Rebecca McLaughlin, and she is the survivor of that awful train accident in Sligo, in which her aunt died. And she talks about the accident and about her aunt's final moments, and it is a terribly, terribly sad story. The Irish Mail on Sunday has the parents of boy B speaking out over the Anna Creagel murder, but I think, my understanding is that this is an interview they did way, way back at the time of the Boy B's conviction, but that because of various appeals and stuff since, they haven't been able to carry it until now. That's my understanding of it, which I do think puts a slightly different complexion on it. But anyway, that his parents are speaking out there, and they are at pains to say they're not making it about themselves. They are at pains to talk about the Creagel family and how they have suffered far, far more. The Sunday World has that the ongoing kind of back and forth, really, around the Conor McGregor sex abuse accusations. The Sun on Sunday leads with Christy Dignam's funeral. Christy leaves Crazy World, and so does the Mer, idol, legend, beloved. Thousands line the streets to say goodbye to Aslan hero. Okay, our panel this morning, Ciara Phelan is a political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Marie-Louise O'Donnell is a broadcaster and former senator. Kevin Callanan is the president of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. And Dan O'Brien is the chief economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs. And we are also going to be joined for this part of the show on the line by Declan Power, security analyst. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So look, we'll start with the front of the Business Post, Ciara. Can you just to set us up there, give us a rundown on a few highlights of what the president was saying about the forum on defence and all of that?
Mm. So this is obviously ahead of the consultative forum set up by the government with Taoiseach Micheál Martin, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, which will start later this week. And in what has been described by some sources, an extraordinary commentary by President D. Higgins, he has said on the front of the Sunday Business Post that Ireland's playing fire during a dangerous period of drift in its foreign policy and must avoid burying ourselves in other people's agendas. He also said that the country finds itself in a particularly acute moment, noting that the most dangerous moment in the articulation and formulation of foreign policy and its practice since the origin of diplomacy has been when you're drifting and not knowing when you're doing so. He added, "I would describe our present position as one of drift." He also, it appears, to criticise the upcoming consultative forum on the international security policy. He said that the composition of the various panels was mostly made up of the admirals, the generals, the Air Force, the rest of it, as well as the formerly neutral countries who are now joining NATO. He asked why there was no representation from still neutral countries such as Austria and Malta, and he was critical too of the European Union for its increasing military posturing.
Okay, and yeah, and he goes on to then discuss the future of the UN, which he thinks lies with Africa, South America and Asia rather than Europe, and lots more in there. Marie-Louise, I'd say you're a fan of the president, are you?
Yes, I am.
Are you a fan of this intervention?
Yes, I am. I am. I think he's terrific. I think he's completely correct. I mean, I'm not in the military. I'm not Declan Power. I'm not Tom Clonan. I'm not on. But I think I, as a citizen of this country, as retired citizens of this country, I do not think we should join NATO. I mean, that is my personal feeling. I also think that NATO's expansion...
Are we proposing to join NATO?
Well, there's lots of discussion about it, and there's going to be all kinds of organisations about it, and there's also going to be all kinds of seminars about it. I also think...
Let's be fair to everyone. The 4 days of the Consultative Forum on International Security Policy, there will be 18 panel discussions, two about neutrality and one about NATO.
Yes, but
so
he's...
It would seem the President is the one who is bringing...
I think when I look at the war in Ukraine, it is my opinion that it's the expansion of NATO, ballistic missiles in Romania and in Portugal, and the expansion into 12 countries for the last, I don't know, many years, that has fueled a lot of this. And that's a bigger issue. But
has fueled it in the sense that
It's fueled it in the sense that it's a proxy war between America, and I am very much in favour of Claire Daly. Relation to this, that it's a proxy war between America and Russia, of which Ukraine.
Hang on, Russia invaded. We know a that. Completely innocent country. Yes. But do you know that?
Yes. But if why are we in, we are involved? We are involved through arms, through Europe, through America. We are involved.
One of those people who thinks that the West provoked.
Absolutely. I do think that. I know that's a very general thing. It's probably the president hasn't gone there, but somewhere behind all this, you know, that we are now going to possibly become part of NATO and be part of this, and the arms race and the arms deals and the arms money. At some stage, people have to negotiate because young people are dying. I understand that Russia invaded Ukraine. I don't know how you balance that with some form of negotiation of peace. You don't do it by adding more arms, adding more planes, adding more ground-to-air missiles.
So we shouldn't be helping the Ukrainians to defend themselves against a huge invader?
Well, I am a person that believes that we should begin with peace talks. Or at least try to get some peace talks around the table. Now, maybe people are very gung-ho and consider that romantic, but that's my feeling. And I think the president is saying very real things about our neutrality, which we hold very dearly in our lives. I do anyway, as a citizen of this country.
I think every poll shows that people are overwhelmingly in favour of neutrality, whatever that means. Dan, what do you make of that?
Of what's just been said or the newspaper?
Will we go back to the president first, maybe?
Yeah, well, if the president had come out and said we should follow long-time neutrals, Finland and Sweden, into NATO, I'd say exactly the same thing. We have a government. We have a foreign minister and a foreign ministry that conduct foreign policy. We don't have a second foreign policy being run out of Orson Uchtron. It is not the role of the president to get involved in policy matters and start criticising the government and criticising the EU and criticising NATO. That is simply not the job of the president.
The president seems to have stretched the role, though, and nobody is stopping him.
Well, that was my second point, is that until...
Most people seem to agree with most of these interventions he makes.
That's debatable, but the government has sat
most
back.
Most people agreed with his intervention on housing. The poll showed it, overwhelmingly.
So my point is that the government has not stood up for itself and said, we make policy... It is not the president who makes policy.
They possibly
and as long
haven't
as they
had
don't,
the chance to do that. But I think there is the narrative around that is that they all the politicians know that the president is more popular than them, and they're not
and
going
more
to be communi- seen to
more communicative. He's a much a better communicator.
Okay, well, in your opinion, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think it's a really important intervention. He's not making policy. He's making an intervention, and he's calling attention to an important issue. And he's very clear and categorical that he criticises the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's buried in the piece.
It is in there, in fairness, yeah. But what about those saying that the future of the UN lies with Africa, Asia, South America? Certainly Africa, Asia, they are the countries that have been abstaining on supporting Ukraine in motions and condemning Russia, aren't they?
I think what he is... drawing attention to is that we live in a global world with lots of member states. We see it in our own global trade union federations, the way in which this has divided the world. And he's saying we can't just leave it to the superpowers, mm-hmm. whether it's Russia or the US, that the future of the world has to be in rehabilitating the United Nations. And like Ireland, and he's saying, are positive.
With Africa as the main, as one of the main powers behind it there, the Africa having gone up with what most people seem to agree was a Russian sympathetic kind of bogus peace talk deal up to Ukraine and Russia this week.
Well, there are clearly countries around the world in Africa, Asia, Latin America that fall under the influence of different blocs, whether it's the so-called Western blocs or the Russian blocs. And that's because their experience in a lot of cases has been they've been victims of imperialism, victims of US imperialism. So, yeah. You know, the politics...
And they make the point as well that America gives us a lecture, the Chinese give us a bridge or a road, I think is part of it too.
Yeah, so the politics is complicated. But if we're going to have a better world, we have to have a way in which all of these voices can be heard. We have to have a process where we defend democracy. Democracy is under threat right across the world. And the United Nations, I think, and rehabilitating the United Nations, which is what I think the president is getting at, is the way forward. And I don't think we would have been as successful as a country in securing our place, our temporary position on the UN Security Council, if we hadn't been coming from a base where we had practiced neutrality over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's bring in Declan Power, defence analyst. Declan, there's a lot to unpack here. Can I ask you first, you're actually going to be speaking at this consultative forum on international security policy. As I pointed out already, like a fraction of the conversation seems to be about neutrality, one out of 18 about NATO. What's your understanding of what the conversation that is going to be happening at it is about?
Well, I can tell you, it's not a simple conversation about neutrality versus NATO. In fact, membership of NATO, I'm not aware that it's been discussed significantly at any point throughout this. I'm taking part in a panel discussion about the concept of the triple lock mechanism, which governs our deployment of troops, and the difficulties that this has created for us, and the shackles it has put on a country that values its independence and course of action when it comes to foreign policy. The problem I would say with this is that people are getting a little bit hysterical and not looking at the facts. And the facts are, we need, the forum allows us the need to discuss the concept of the threats facing Ireland as they are today, to determine them. And there are a variety, there's a spectrum. And a lot of them are in the hybrid area.
Yeah, I'm just trying to be fair to everyone here, Declan. So I'll just interject there to say that topics to be covered include European security post Ukraine, cyber security, maritime security, critical infrastructure, disinformation. So they're the kind of new threats you're talking about.
Precisely, yeah. And then having determined that there is a nature of threat, what are the arrangements, facilities, mechanisms that we can employ to counter that threat, and that requires us to be agile in our thinking. And if we don't do that, we're being remiss in our duties to the state.
Where can the conversation go? So do you think, or where are the mechanisms that allow us to keep our neutrality, but to maybe protect ourselves better against all these things?
Okay, well, it starts with, I think, that we stop deceiving ourselves, that we start to look at the facts. Conor Gallagher brought out a very, very effective readable book there recently called Is Ireland Neutral? The Myths of Irish Neutrality. And it follows on an excellent work done by Professor Eoin Ó Halpin from the same parish as one of your speakers there. And in fact, if I could just make the point to Marie-Louise, when she was talking about the war in Ukraine, the Ukrainians gave back their missiles, their nuclear missiles, in 1996 or 98 to Russia in an attempt to appease them, and we saw how that worked. So what I'm saying is we need to start looking at the elements of reality as to where we are today with our policies, our processes, and our procedures. And then we examine them, are they fit for purpose? And then we develop other alternatives. And there are many
So you're saying this is not, like, I suppose,
at.
Declan, one, sorry to interrupt you. One man might see as drift, you are seeing as that we are having a conversation around this and looking at the realities of what's going on in the world. Would you say this is not drift, really?
Absolutely not. No, and I think I think the president has moved into a sphere that he is very ideologically motivated about, but is not operationally aware about. And I think that's disappointing. Particularly his comments about conflating investment in the defence forces with improvement and addressing abuse issues, because the reality is that's one of our significant pillars in our national security. And if we were to say that we
The president's the head of the army, right, ultimately?
Yeah. And there are those, I can tell you now today, there are those wearing the uniform that will be disappointed that their commander-in-chief has taken that approach. They will see it, some will see it as an attempt to paint everybody in the same brush and to not to see the fundamentals, which are to allow the defence forces to do their constitutionally mandated role, which is to be in the lead of protection of the state. And if I could come back to one other point, though, that's important to understand here. I have worked with a lot of organisations, regional organisations over the years, including NATO, as an instructor, trainer and various other roles. And I'm not saying that we should join NATO, and a lot of people in my space are saying the same thing. But what we do need to realise is there are a lot of things going on in our sphere of the world, and we need to have proper mechanisms for relationship, because the thing I fear the most with regards to the ongoing deterioration of security is not a missile strike from Russia into Ireland or an invasion, but an increase in hybrid activities that undermine our capacity, and then also reactions from other players. And we're not at the table when decisions are made that affect our national integrity and the safety of our citizens.
Okay, Ciara.
Just in terms of Declan's comments on, you know, he's saying that he doesn't think it's more so a drift. But, you know, if you look at the Taoiseach's words when he spoke in the Dáil back in May, and he did point out some of the issues that Declan has raised in terms of cybersecurity threat, but the Taoiseach has said that Ireland has to ramp up military capacity in order to protect itself against, you know, the likes of the critical undersea fibre optic cables that we believe that may have been a threat recently. He said our geographic location for security...
We are a world centre for pharma, which is where the wars of the future is going to come out of labs. Mm-hmm. We're a world centre for data. The wars of the future are going to be all about that. So, is it not right that we do need to be thinking about how we defend ourselves and not relying on, you know, old agreements with the UK?
Well, a lot of people would argue that's what this consultative forum is about, is the first step in examining what we need to do to further protect ourselves down the line, given that we've seen endless reports about the lack of capacity in our military, the defence forces in the maritime, the Navy. We've seen endless reports about that. And this is what the first step is, because like he has recognised that we can't depend on our geolocation anymore. There's changes in the world, and the Ireland that we live in today is different to many moons ago.
Okay.
Declan,
hang on a minute. You had a good run there. Now, Marie-Louise wants to get back in.
Yes, hello, Declan.
I don't
mean to undermine anything you say, and neither would I contradict it in the sense that you know your business. I'm just an observer, a kind of a retired observer. But in the paper, it does say in the Business Post by Barry White, he does quote the president, and I'd like your opinion on this, where he talks about, in relation to the Consultative Forum on International Security Policy, the composition of the various panels was mostly made up of admirals, generals, the Air Force, the rest of it, and as well as the formerly neutral countries who are now joining NATO.
I can give you a response to that, which is that there will be historians, representatives of people from big business like Dell, NGOs such as Concern and Oxfam, diplomats, well-known academics, Bridget Laffin of the European University Institute, Gary Murphy of DCU. So I think, yes, there are military people there, but there seem to be a lot of other people there as well. I think the president could be accused of kind of slightly misrepresenting it there, whether by accident or not.
And no representation from still neutral countries such as Austria and Malta. No, it's just a question.
It is. And Marie-Louise raises an interesting point. Now, I think we have to understand that the composition has been determined about Ireland's needs And so, you know, Austria and Malta live in kind of different neighbourhoods in different respects. And so it's not a conference about the essence of neutrality. And I really mean my point about we need to read up more about it, because if you look at the history of our type of neutrality, it's very different. In fact, to be honest, I wouldn't even call it neutrality. I would call it independence in course of action. And we have done things and we have taken stances that are distinctly non-neutral. And we're the only country that call ourselves militarily neutral. Now, do you know what? We can take whatever stance we want, but it doesn't have to be binary. We shouldn't be ignoring the steps we need to take to protect ourselves, to protect our citizens. And we have been willfully and blissfully ignorant about that for a number of decades. And we can't let that continue. It's simply unconscionable.
Okay. Kira, the politics of this, as I was kind of alluding to earlier, politicians don't tend to publicly
criticise
the president even when he makes these kind of interventions. How is this going to play out over the next... The forum starts on Thursday, I think.
Yeah.
So presumably this is going to be a conversation for the next few days.
It'll run all week now. It'll obviously, I'd say, dominate leaders' questions as well. You'll definitely have the opposition parties coming out. They have been critical of the forum already. It's radio silence so far from government sources this morning because they're probably battling with do they come out and criticise or, you know, stay clear of commenting on what the president has said. More so, I suspect that they'll just give a broader outline, which I suspect that you've got, that what the consultative forum is going to consist of. But
that is publicly available information that we chose to go and find.
Yes, but
we weren't briefed by anyone on
no,
it.
No, I'm like saying that, if you get a statement, but like
that
I have...
information's out there.
Yes, it is. But like I said, if I've contacted the government press service this morning looking for a response on the president's comments, I'm not likely to get that.
They're giving flat information is what they're going to
give out. About the details of the consultative
which
forum.
Which would appear to contradict what the president has said.
In terms of, yes.
In terms of the makeup of it
and the number of speakers that are at it. And I think the issue here, though, which will really frustrate the government, is that the president has come out and criticised a policy, this consultative forum, before it has even began. So what does that set, what the agenda that is set then for the week and for this forum is already mirrored in controversy, which it has been criticised in the Dáil during the week by the likes of people before.
That's
profit.
Unusual, Dan, isn't it? That, like, the president often speaks in kind of broad landscapes, and I think he has, in fair, I think the broader undercurrent to a lot of this, I haven't read my Franz Fanon in a while, is a kind of this post-colonialist versus the colonised kind of thing. But he has, at the very specific end of it, directly criticised a government initiative, hasn't he? He's eviscerated it, really, on the front page of a Sunday paper. This is new territory, is it?
Well, I recall writing an article as long as 10 years ago criticising the president for intervening in the area of policy. I just don't think it's the role of the president. But anyway, that's that. I'd just like to just make a broader point that, you know, you go to European capitals, and I've been working in this sort of area for 20 years, parties on the centre-left, centre-right, thing you hear so often is the twin pillars of our foreign policy, the EU and NATO. Nearly every country in Europe is in the EU and NATO. Around our neighbourhood, every country on the Atlantic, go to Iceland, to Portugal, Canada, Norway, all of the countries looking out onto the Atlantic, Northern Ireland, Britain, everyone is in NATO. We are the only country that's decided this is not a good idea. Now, maybe every single one of our neighbours is wrong and we're right. But I think people should just, you know, I think sometimes we have, there's a thing about NATO in this country that's a bit like the Brexiteers have in Britain about the EU.
Marie-Louise.
Well, I think sometimes we forget the man here, you know. I mean, he is an idealist, he's a thinker, he's a debater, he's a cultural socialist, a sociologist rather. And I really admire it because it, he's standing
you
up
see,
for something.
I understand what Declan is saying, but is that his role
oh,
as
Lord.
President is the question people might ask. That
that's
it's,
true.
It's good that we have public intellectuals and thinkers and everything, but he's not Fintan O'Toole, like, he's the president.
Yes, but you know, the boundaries, more of our boundaries every day are getting loosened, aren't they, between what people should be doing, are doing and might be doing.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
those boundaries are coming down in lots of ways.
Kevin, is that a fair point Marie-Louise is making, that the president has grown this role organically and that actually it's a very popular thing he's doing? People seem to support it.
Well, thankfully he is. You mentioned housing earlier. I mean, thank goodness he did draw attention to it.
So should we change the constitution then, maybe? Is that what would be required here to change the role?
But with what purpose? If we have
a
divided government...
To have a president like this that seems to delight the people, a lot of the people.
But, what you know, do we want two governments?
Oh, not two governments.
Well, Dan, I think that's...
Sometimes the politicians don't think.
Kevin, what? Yeah.
No, I think that's stretching it. He is using his position to bring attention to legitimate concerns. And let's remember, Dan said he wrote an article 10 years ago criticising him. I mean, in the polls leading up to the election, he had 2/3 of the vote. I think a lot of people didn't turn up to vote on the day because he had such a commanding lead. He still got almost 56%
of the vote. But Kevin, is he misrepresenting a government initiative today?
No. How could it think?
I think it's... Is he not...
Yeah, Declan, you think he is? Yeah, Kevin, you think... Let Kevin say first why he's not.
Okay.
No, I don't think he is. I think it's legitimate that these things are being discussed and raised. I think a lot of people
But does he have his basic facts right? I don't want to be disrespectful to the president, but is he misrepresenting it?
Well, I can't speak for the president, but I think a lot of people looking at this will see, given the broader landscape that we're looking at, the distinction between this process and, for instance, the Citizens' Assembly. I don't think this is a bad thing of itself. I think the issues do
and
need
I'd
to
gather
be heard.
Anyone can register to come along, and I'd gather they can... Kira, am I right in saying people can speak at it if they want as well?
And you can make a submission up until the... I think it's mid-July. You can make written submissions as well, and the government are calling on that for people to do that.
If you believe in the idea of Socrates, who said that the fundamental of thought is questions, he has every right to ask questions as an idealist about this, as the president of our country.
Okay, and people might argue that he's making statements there, actually.
Brendan, one final word. One point. Look, I understand, and it's right that the president should be able to ask questions, but he has a huge platform. And I think he's using that platform to make statements about something that he hasn't fully done his homework on. He has a very strong ideological position. My concern is it sways people in a direction before they've even got to hear the current information. This is not a citizens' assembly that's happening. It's something that will allow people think about things based on factual information put at their disposal, and then we move forward from that. That's the way it should go. And I fear he may have unintentionally tried to derail that.
Okay, and you know what the result of it could be, though, is that suddenly everyone's paying attention to this forum next week.
Yes, indeed.
Okay,
indeed.
Listen, Declan Power, you're going to leave us now. Thanks very much. We'll take a break, and Kira Phelan, Marie-Louise O'Donnell, Kevin Callanan and Dan O'Brien are staying with us. And by the way, look, I'm sure the president would say that he has done his homework on all this and that, you know, he has formulated his thoughts very carefully on it, as he does about all the issues that he intervenes on. He's a man who reads a lot and thinks a lot about things, and we are not, I'm in no way suggesting that that he didn't think about and inform himself about what he was talking about here. We'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Kira Phelan, Marie-Louise O'Donnell, Kevin Callanan and Dan O'Brien are still with us. And so as you've talked about presidential politics, we talk about actual politics. Now, Kira, you picked that piece on front of the Sunday Times. So there's an interview with Leo Varadkar there, and he's saying there's no vacancy at the top of Fine Gael. And this has been gnawing along there for the last couple of weeks at this stage.
Yeah, the interview with Claire Scott, I believe it happened in Jersey there at the British Irish Council on Friday. Yeah, I thought the interesting point about it that struck out to me was, you know, there has been a lot of discussion in Leinster House about how perhaps he doesn't seem as energetic this time around as Taoiseach, that, you know, he's gone bored of the role, and he's defending that in the paper today, saying that...
Is this the conversation in Leinster House? Now, among
politicians. And those who comment as well, so, like political reporters who would have, been with him.
It is with politicians
that, and he did address it. He said, look, it's the second time around. He's a bit older, a bit more mature, maybe a bit more serious about it. But the whole issue of what appeared in the papers last weekend didn't go away. It was still the chit-chat in Leinster House during the week in terms of, at the PP meeting on Wednesday night, he addressed it. He said it would be remiss of him not to do so. He urged people not to talk to the media and to come to talk to him. His phone was always on. His door was always open. And
rousing support from everyone there, I gather.
Yeah, look, you'll always get that. And the people that are there, praise him to his face, are the very ones that will come out and send you a text message afterwards. Now, there was two politicians, I believe Charlie Flanagan and Michael Creed, both former ministers, who did say, there was a disconnect between backbenchers and ministers, which actually instigated Heather Humphreys, the Social Protection Minister, to interfere and say, well, hold on a second, Charlie, we might have to have a conversation about that because I meet with all my backbenchers. There has been discussion about how Fine Gael have dropped in some of the polls, have risen in some, but there was concern about the drop in support in Dublin and particularly among...
And this is a piece in the Business Post today.
Today,
they're basing this now, and people get confused.
On the Irish Times poll during the week,
which suggested that there is a drop among... older voters and Dublin
and in
voters.
Dublin, and as politicians, and it's reported in the Sunday Business Post that they said that they depended heavily on Dublin in the last general election. There is obviously the continued conversation about his leadership, the success of that, and although, as he's saying, there's no vacancy at the top of Fine Gael, it seems like the pathway to that has begun down the line.
Yeah, okay. And look, there, as someone points out today, Enda had Simon and Leo, and Leo now potentially has Simon and Helen. Mm. That a leader will always, at a
and
particular
Heather,
point,
people
have,
would say, yeah.
have people hovering around there. Marie-Louise, you picked that piece as well.
He's kind of all over a lot of the papers, Leo, because in one way the thunder is 15 miles out, and it started and it's on its way in, and the bangs are going to get bigger the nearer they come to it. And I think that there's always a vacancy in politics. There's always a vacancy.
Okay.
There's always somebody ready to jump in. Leo is, sometimes I think he's his own worst enemy. I mean, he's a very fine politician, but my personal opinion, he's a very fine politician. He's sure and he's confident and he's convinced. A lot of what he does. He's convinced of his own policies.
So conviction.
Conviction. Sometimes he's not clever enough to listen, and he doesn't exercise a common touch, a more common touch with people. And the government seemed to be running, he's got into trouble now, been running from between tax and between the services, that they haven't really made up the mind there.
So
and
this is again, this has came into focus again off the back of that Irish Times poll,
yes.
which suggested
yes.
that when people were asked what's the most important priority for the budget, only I think 10% of them, it was suggested in that poll, picked tax cuts.
People want to understand what it means to have proper social services structures in place and have them working.
Yeah.
I always
now,
think
now
with
we're
Leo,
spending a third more on all that kind of thing.
Yeah,
we
but we don't. Well, we mightn't be managing it.
Out.
We might be spending it. We mightn't be managing it. Sometimes with Leo, I think he's a very fine leader, but he's difficult to know. And he's difficult to catch, and he's more silent at times. And when this idea that he's unapproachable, I'm not too sure about that, politicians, because he came from maybe Enda Kenny was more of
Enda Kenny, who put you in the Shannon.
Yes,
we will just acknowledge, yeah.
And if you don't mind me saying so, on this good Sunday morning, he's very good reason to. I mean, I didn't just walk
move on. So what you're saying is Enda Kenny was a man who went around with his hands stuck out, really.
But he had a better communication. Leo's communication is weak. It's not that Leo is weak, is that the communication is.
Yeah,
and he needs to get a grip on this, because the thunder is on the way, and dirt ban lum, dirt ban lay, and the people on the corridors after the big parliamentary meetings, you know, undermining.
So historically, this kind of chatter, you think, is the beginning of a process?
I do. Yeah. I think it's the beginning of a thunder, yeah, yeah, and he needs yeah. to get a grip of it.
In his defence, I'm not here to defend the government, but a lot of people will say about Leo Varadkar is he's very blunt and to the point that if you ask him something, that he will tell it. In terms of a communicator, he will be a lot better than others. But I think Gary Murphy, actually, in the Sunday Times today, in his piece, he summed it up really well in terms of, you know, that the party speaks, Fine Gael speaks about, you know, we're the party of law and order, we're going to look after the people that get up early in the morning. In Middle Ireland, we've seen that with the proposed budget tax cut, but it's not connecting with the electorate, and that they can talk all about it, but they just can't seem to make the connect there, and they essentially have to set out and they have to basically prove their action. Okay. A lot more action.
I'd say it would connect with the electorate fairly fast if there were no tax cuts.
I think what Gary Murphy really finishes by saying is Kevin. Fine Gael need to give the electorate something to vote for and be clear on that. And what we've seen, including last Monday at the National Economic Dialogue, we saw mixed messages from the Taoiseach from the Minister for Finance and the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform around this whole. Obviously, the coffers are doing very well, and the decisions now are, well, what do we do with it? We've seen the view in the poll running against what some of the Fine Gael deputies that had that article on tax cuts a few weeks ago had been saying. People want to see it invested in infrastructure and in public services. And it's clear,
In fairness, I think that poll asked people their top priority, didn't it? So that, like, it wasn't saying that 90% of people didn't want tax cuts. It's also been pointed out that, am I right in saying nearly half of the workforce in Ireland don't pay tax?
A significant amount of the workforce are paid so little that they don't fall into the tax band.
I understand why, but at the same time, so they're not going to care about tax cuts either. Yeah.
But the interesting thing around the table last Monday, and there was quite a wide range of people represented, was that there was very broad consensus that we need to seize this opportunity to invest in the medium to long term. Mm-hmm. And that is a different message to what we're kind of beginning to see now in the run-up to the next election, where there'll be an attempt to win over people. And there are really important decisions to be made in the next few weeks in the lead-up to the budget in early October.
Okay. And you would say that poll during the week might have indicated that the electorate are actually, Charlie McCreevy, you say we have a very sophisticated electorate, that they are actually mature enough to be thinking about the long term instead of just the next budget and getting something back.
I think people see that the population of the country has grown dramatically, that we were hit very hard by the financial crash. That has affected our public services, our infrastructure, and we need to invest in them. Of course, you know, there may be legitimate questions about what we're doing with the existing resources. That's fair enough. But we have major challenges that we have to address. And the best way to do that is in a collaborative way where we kind of build consensus. We withstand the threat of kind of a breakdown in social cohesion, and we continue to try and take the country forward.
OK, Dan.
I'm just getting more and more of a feeling that we're back in 2005, when there was this sort of sense that boom would go on forever and we were completely bulletproof and invulnerable. Taoiseach of the day at that time famously said to people who were worried about things going wrong that they should end their own lives. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there's an imminent crash coming, but there are so many things that could go wrong. There was recently talk of 65 billion available. This is not 65 billion available. This is, if everything continues to go really well, over 5 years, there could be an aggregate budget surplus of 65 billion. We have no idea. That's going to be wrong, for sure. It may be close to being right. It may be disastrously wrong. There are so many things that could go wrong. We could just have a normal recession. You know, economies go up and down. So I'll give you a real fact. 235 billion. That's how much the government owes. The government still has a massive debt. 235 billion. That's what it owes. Things can go wrong.
You don't pay off national debt. You just, at the moment, it's being inflated away at a ferocious rate. Like, isn't it 230 billion now is not what 230 billion was 2 years ago?
That is true. But I think we got into a sense in 2005-06 that we were invulnerable and it would go on forever. I think it's almost important that people and politicians in particular say, okay, look, you know, things are pretty good at the moment. We've come through really serious challenges in this current decade, and hopefully things will continue to go well. But we can't take that for granted. We are not invulnerable. We're a tiny country.
Dan is right to make that point. But the challenge is, well, what are we going to do to manage these things over the next period? And how are we going to do that? If we have a situation where it becomes more about a Dutch auction for the next general election, the likelihood is we're going to run into trouble.
Kevin, are those tax cuts not, though, for the workers you represent, are they not just for them a compensation for the inflation and for the extra taxes they would be paying on wage rises they might have got to counter inflation?
No, where we would like to see the effect of the cost of living crisis dealt with through wage bargaining, and I think that's the way to go. Interestingly,
wage bargaining for the public sector. Is tax cuts not the way to give everybody more money into their pockets?
No, public and private sectors. I think it's inconsistent. In fact, it's irresponsible to say that, you know, in its circumstances where we're worried about the fact that our corporate tax revenues would dry up, that we're in a position to reduce other tax revenues for the reasons that...
But a lot of people in the private sector will say that it's all very well for, you know, there to be money to be given back through partnership-style agreements and everything else, but that a lot of people in the private sector don't feel in a position to look for pay rises at the moment. I know a lot of them are getting them, but that they would feel that an equitable way for the private and public to get it is through getting tax back.
I think that there's a distinction, Brendan, to be made between adjusting the tax bands so that they keep pace with inflation.
And is actually, that not what's being proposed?
I'm not sure that that was only what was being proposed. I think there was a general, it was being generally floated that we could in some way reduce income tax significantly.
But by doing what they did in the last budget, wasn't it? They adjusted the bands and the rate at which you went into the higher tax band. And that's what they're proposing they would do again, isn't it, as part of an ongoing process to bring it up to it so that you wouldn't end up paying higher tax until you're earning 50,000. Is that not?
And I don't think anybody would disagree with that. That's a reasonable
approach.
So is
that not the tax cut that we're being offered in reality, or that's the tax cut Fine Gael are talking about, is my understanding?
Well, I'm not so sure it is.
I don't think so. I think that they're looking at a different measure. Yeah, no, there has been a commitment to change the tax band again, and at the National Economic Dialogue on last Monday, you know, Finance Minister Michael McGrath said that the government would likely honour that, but the Fine Gael's proposal was different. In terms of the 1,000 tax cut, they were looking for it to come into place in this budget.
Yeah, but I thought it was to do it. We got 842 effectively tax cut the last time, the higher, if you were paying the higher rate. Got 842 through a moving of the bands and the rates.
But the issue about that was that the conversation about the budgetary process and what was going to happen hadn't taken place. That's why there was so much criticism about it. But I do think it was separate to that.
Okay. Dan, should people get tax cuts in this budget?
I think that's very much a government decision on how...
I know, but as an economist, what do you think?
Well, sorry to be sort of dismalist, but at the moment, the economy doesn't need stimulus, whether it's through increased public spending or more tax cuts. So that's purely, we've got an inflation problem, unfortunately. It's not going away as I hoped it would. It's still around. You stimulate the economy more, whether it's with additional spending or more tax cuts, you're going to have more of an inflation
problem. So actually, the whole point of increased interest rates is people have to feel that pain, yeah?
That's the...
Kevin, is that the unfortunate truth of it?
No, but I don't think that's going to be a political runner. What I'd like to see is a situation where we look at pay increases, but maybe a combination of pay increases. We've seen a major deal in Germany in the last month where there's a combination of inflation compensation in the form of lump sum payments that are tax-free and deduction-free combined with regular pay increases that obviously attract
tax. But if we're compensating people for the tightening of money that's happening, we want that tightening, we want it to happen, don't we, in rough economic terms?
Well, I don't really think, you know, we can get away from the fact that, you know, people are going to need to be compensated in order to deal with the reality of the cost of living pressures. If we do it in that way, there's a good chance there's a certainty that that will in turn bring revenue back into the coffers and keep the economy in good shape.
Okay. And look, just for clarity, Fine Gael's plan would aim for a €1,000 benefit driven by a combination of a change in the tax in the rate bands and a 100% increase in personal tax credits from 1775, 100 euro increase in personal tax credits from 1775 to 1875.
Can I just say something to Dan? I don't think, Dan, for one minute that we think everything is going fine. I mean, you don't actually believe that, do you? Because I am very aware of there's not enough consultants, there's not enough houses, there's not enough places for disability services, there's not enough special needs, there's not enough for the aged, the price of food, people can't put on their lights and put on their heat. So this idea that it's all going well now and everything is fine, and that we don't need an injection, whether by tax or whether by lump sum, is absolutely crazy. Because this country needs to really get a mirror and put it up to itself and find out how are we going to deal with the fact that many, many people of Middle Ireland cannot live
at a time when many companies are making extraordinary profits. You know, it's...
You were saying, maybe you just said that in the wrong context.
I'm not saying that this is paradise and everything's perfect. I'm simply saying that we're a tiny economy that bobs along on an ocean, that all those currents affect us. We don't control them. And the notion that we have 65 billion to splurge has taken hold. It's based on purely a forecast that everything goes well economically. And I'm saying that we got into that mentality in 2005, saying there's nothing to worry about, nothing can go wrong, we have boom forever, money's going to roll in, we can spend whatever we want. And look where that ended. I'm simply saying that we need to just be aware that things can go wrong and not assume everything's going to be fine and everything can be paid for. And every bad thing that happens, the government can come along like our parents and compensate us for and make things right.
Yes,
okay, we'll take a break. Ciara Fila, Mary-Louise O'Donnell, Kevin Callanan and Dan O'Brien staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Everybody's calmed down slightly, so we'll go again. Ciara Fila, Mary-Louise O'Donnell, Kevin Callanan and Dan O'Brien still with us. And let's go to another hot potato now. Dan, you picked a piece on assisted dying in the Sunday Times. And this is a piece by Bo Donnelly. And it's a case study of I have MDN, no cure. Let me go with a bit of dignity, says this woman.
Yeah, it's an issue that I've always instinctively been in favour of, that if people are at a stage in life where they want to end their own lives and to do so with dignity. But some things have been coming out of Canada, which went ahead with that, that suggest to me that I think we might need to think again about it and that we could have what's called a late mover advantage on this. Let's hold back and let other countries play it out and see, because it's obviously
very, very serious. Canada has now paused, I think. They were rolling it out to more and more constituencies, but I think they've stopped now for the moment. There's a pause in it for a year.
Okay, I haven't seen the pause, but I've certainly seen issues around people.
I think possibly mental health was the next one, and I think they've paused there. I'm open to correction on that. I think also that 7% of deaths in Canada are now...
So it's exactly that figure. So when 7% of people are dying with assisted suicide, you know, it's a very big number. And I think it's a very delicate issue. It's a very sensitive issue. I always thought that I was very much in favour, but what's happening in Canada, I just think we need to watch that very carefully.
And we are having a very careful, I think, and it sounds like a comprehensive, thoughtful conversation about it there's a committee on it led by Michael Healy-Ray, who in fairness says he's putting his own pro-life views to one side in favour of an open conversation. Mary-Louise, you have previous in this area.
I wrote a report for the government called Dying, Death and Bereavement in 2016, a big report on what was really around for people who were actively dying or in the process of dying or had terminal illness and were facing death and leaving Ireland and leaving the planet. And the systems that weren't in place to help them, you know, systems at home, hospice at home, hospice within hospitals. I mean, that is developing. Electricity bills that were too high, heating bills that were too high, food. The needs of the living that are dying. It was really about that. I didn't look at any element of assisted dying, euthanasia, any element like that, because that takes you down a different road.
Yeah.
And I really
think... But end of life is such an important thing that people forget. And you know, there's that whole thing of that if someone is feeling pain at 9 out of 10 for 9 yes. minutes, yes. and then they feel pain at 2 out of 10 for 10 minutes,
yes.
and you say to them at the end, how was the pain? They say it averaged about 4. If somebody feels no pain for 9 minutes, huge pain at the end, it colours the whole experience. Yes. Endings are so important.
Yes, and not
they?
Only
how
that.
How your life ends colours your whole kind of story.
And not only does it colour your whole story, but it colours the people looking at you who are left behind in the grief, that they live with the way you died or the way you went through pain to the point where of distraction, and that their lives become choked.
Because did anything happen as a result of your
deliberations? Well, it's very interesting. And I actually use extraordinary photography and literature, and I even look at Lasnevin Cemetery. I try to use all aspects of dying, because it, I can tell you, it's the one thing that's going to happen us all, and none of us are going to get out of it, and how everybody wants a good death. And the hospice would try and do that with being pain-free, help people to be pain-free, to die well, to die peacefully.
And I think everyone agrees naturally. The hospices do an extraordinary job.
Extraordinary job. And they neither, you know, encourage death, or they neither stop. They bring about the natural aspect of it, and they try to have people die naturally. It's very, very difficult. The Canadian, as you said, Dan, is an example that really... if you were arguing one way, it would maybe make you stop to think again. I don't know, you know, suicide is not illegal, yet assisting somebody to commit suicide in Ireland is illegal. I don't know, and because the older our population gets, then do they become, you know, where is the arbitrary, where do you stop? Where do you say that somebody is... you know, should die or can die or should be allowed die or want to die? Where do you stop? When does it stop? At what point is that decision made? And at what point is that decision outside itself? It's a very, very difficult area, discipline. And it'll take a lot of... I'll marvel at Michael Healy-Ray now, because it's very difficult to leave your own pathology behind here, you know, yeah. but I'm thinking he may be able to, and have all these...
Do you think it's a conversation we need to have, and do you think it's the way things are inevitably going?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a very brilliant article about elder abuse is shrouded in darkness, is only getting worse, about psychological abuse and coercive abuse.
Yeah, this is Julia Maloney in the Sunday Independent.
Paper. And we are becoming old. I remember my father standing at the door when he had cancer, and he was going back to the hospital, and he turned to me, was trying to put on his coat, and he said, "Oh God," he said, "I'm only an old nuisance." Now that turn you, because people getting older, they think they're becoming a nuisance, or they think they're becoming dysfunctional or useless. They've nothing to say, no gift to give. And we are, as a society, becoming more divided against the wisdom of the elder. What about people who have slight dementia? You know, well, I mean, it's a very, very difficult situation as we get older. And this article tells us, you know, about the amount of 3,400 complaints with Patricia Rickard-Clark through the Sage Advisory Service, getting yeah. older, lonely lives, separated from children because people have to work in other countries.
It's interesting what Marie-Louise says there, Kevin, about the nuisance thing, isn't it? Mm. Does it feed into a broader kind of modern thing of like that you're either useful or you're not?
Yes, valued.
And that is that going to feed into the conversation around assisted suicide as well then? This kind of transactional society almost?
Yeah, I think that's a danger. I think some of the work that was done on helping people to express their wishes and all is really, that we see promoted now, is really important. I know that woman, Patricia Rickard-Clark, was heavily involved in that several decades ago. I think we need to value everyone. One of the things that really struck me, Brendan, last Monday at the National Economic Dialogue, where there was a lot of reference to the fact that we're at a historically low level of unemployment, is just... the really low level of employment among our people with a disability.
Mm.
You know, that's just unacceptable in a modern, wealthy country. And, you know, these are things that we have to face up to and
also the Assistant Decision-Making Capacity Act. I want to be allowed to die. Do not keep me alive and jump up and down on my chest or peg feed me, let me go. The people can make that decision. In other words, if they had a heart attack, that they wouldn't try to keep them alive, that they would be allowed move off naturally. That's a very important act that's coming in to allow people make that decision, maybe long before
you know, because there is a tendency to keep people alive outside their wishes to stay alive.
Okay, listen, just before we finish up, Ciara, a lot across the papers today about Christy Dignam and his funeral yesterday.
Yeah, obviously you've seen the videos and pictures on social media yesterday of the cortege making its way towards the chapel. It was really touching, absolutely beautiful moments where people were lining the streets and recalling their memories of Christy Dignam, and for the family as well to see that, to see how much he was loved, and for those that were close to him, it was very poignant and special. I actually have one memory of Christy Dignam. I was quite young, working at a different radio station. A friend of mine was obsessed with him, loved him, and it happened to be her birthday the week later. He was in as a guest on the show, and I just ran up and said, would you mind taking a quick video? And he was more than happy to do it, and actually did it more than once, because he didn't like what he said the first time around. So I think that's what Christy was like. He helped people, wanted to make people happy, and I think the communities that flocked the streets yesterday showed that's the case, how many people felt.
Okay, thanks for that, Ciara Feeling.
How can I protect you in this crazy world?
Okay, I think when Mary-Louise O'Donnell starts singing, it is time to go. Ciara Feeling, Mary-Louise O'Donnell, Kevin Callanan and Dan O'Brien, thank you all very much. That was a fantastic hour, if I say so myself. And it is just coming up to 12 noon, and we'll go to Kate Egan in the newsroom.